You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.
My guest on Line Noise this week is DJ producer extraordinaire Errol Alkan. We spoke about a lot of things. We spoke about the new remixes of his classic track A Hold on Love, kind of a 11th anniversary special. We spoke about Euphoric Melancholy, which is one of the greatest things in the history of dance music. We spoke about the art of remixing. We spoke about Trash. We touched on Daft Punk, Chemical Brothers, all kinds of things. Thank you so much to Errol for doing the interview, because we really spoke for a very long time and he was very, very accommodating. So thanks to him for that and enjoy it.
Okay, so one of the reasons we're talking is because Hold On Love is coming out later this year, a new two remixes by yourself. First came out in 2013. Why did you decide to bring it out again?
I was finding that I was, well, whenever I played A Hold On Love, I'd always play at the end of the set, the DJ set, because it kind of felt like it had a bit of a melancholy finality about it. And it just ended up that way. It was just always sometimes if I played it, it'd be the last song in my set. And that's kind of nice when you have a track that does that. But at the same time, I kind of wanted there to be a bit more like versatility to it, you know, because especially because it is kind of such a basic thing. So I had kind of experimented whilst playing live. I would have different drums underneath it and play it faster and stuff and experimented, and then kind of realized that there was a place for it elsewhere in my sets. But I kind of had to make, you know, just had to go away and just like make a re-edit or a new version of it or something like that. So I wanted to do that. I mean, last year I had a real hunger to make things for my own DJ sets, like my own edits. You know, I made one of like the KLF's What Time Is Love, where I took four different versions of What Time Is Love and took the best bit from each version and made one version out of it. You know, I kind of want to have versions of a track that no one else has got, you know, because it goes back to how it, you know, that, or let me, or maybe I should say, you know, that aspect of being a DJ or sharing music with people, you know, like having something that's familiar but completely bespoke has always been at the heart of what I do and who I am. It goes back to when I first started DJing in indie clubs. You know, I would sometimes look for like demo versions or live versions of tracks that people knew, you know, just to have something that was different to what everyone else was playing. You know, even to a point when there was a video wall at the club, I rigged up the video machine to the video wall, but took the audio out and put it into the mixing desk, so I could play live performances, like TV performances and stuff like that, you know, things like The Word or whatever. You know, I'd know where it was on the VHS tape, and then I'd cue it up and then play that. So the visual and the audio was obviously synced, and people would, you know, see and hear something rather than just hear it, but it'd be a different version. And I found that exciting, you know, pre-internet, pre-everything that we kind of know now, just that difference went a long way. And I think, you know, from just wanting to just give it a bit of a different slant. And then I then realized that from, as I was mixing that version, I started mucking around with it, muting some aspects, and made a really nice stripped back version of it that I really liked, that I realized I could play another part of my own DJ sets. You know, I could play earlier on in the night, and I could play it amongst like these kind of trippier, more like, I suppose, chuggier is a word also to use, you know, part of my sets. So having that versatility was really exciting for me. And then I thought, well, I could do this with lots of like my own records. Like, why not, you know? Because ultimately you're making music for the dance floor. Dance floors change. They evolve. You know, if you've got something that has a recognizable motif, you could be bold with it. You can you know, manipulate it.
Do you kind of feel you have to do that even more these days now that everyone's got access to everything?
I think you can get by with access to everything. A lot of huge DJs do, you know, or as an addition to that, a lot of big DJs will have their own, you know, label or maybe even their own ecosystem of other producers who will give them records first. It feels like that window of something being unknown and fresh and then being available is getting like narrower and narrower. Pretty much because, and understandably so, you know, people want to release music faster. And also with electronic music or club music in general, you know, the promotion is done on the dance floor, really, you know. And that could be the most effective way of it reaching people, especially in the sense of people filming things and what your track IDs and stuff like that. So I feel that... You know, I also feel that you can go to a lot of effort and make things different and have that bespoke aspect to who you are and what you do and be very, very unique. And in this business, in DJing now, you could very easily go completely unnoticed. You know, I come across a lot of fantastic DJs, a lot of people who have great musical minds and who are clearly creative and, you know, completely committed to what they do. And they'll be doing things in the sense of like what you've just described, you know, bespoke versions of things or making their own music or whatever, and it can easily go unnoticed. But that's unfortunately one of the, you know, unfortunate sides of, you know, how, you know, what has happened within DJ culture, club culture, etc.
I've seen Hold On Love build as like your debut release. I mean, it's kind of your debut solo release.
Yeah, that's clearer. Yeah, definitely.
And it's important to you. I guess it's important to you for that. But like, why else is it such an important track for you?
Why is it important to me? I mean, I think with anything that I put out, you know, there's a sense of achievement or importance in the sense that I've got to that point where I've liked something enough to put it out, or I feel that it's something that like balances or straddles the sensibilities that I'm part of, you know. I think I think with that track in particular, a lot of people have kind of said to me about how they feel about it. I think the record, the music itself, was heightened considerably by the video, because I feel the video, which was directed and made by Daniel Brereton, had such a connection with people. I think that bolstered the music, you know, which I love that happened. And I think for that reason, it may sit in people's hearts maybe a little deeper than it would have done without the video as well. I'll be very honest in that, because I feel that these things, you know, if you can make a piece of music which inspires a video, which then inspires something else or whatever, then that's kind of what you want, you know. Like, I don't really know why it took a bit of a life on beyond other things, but it just did. I also think it being a debut, like my debut thing that I put out under my own name, was quite a big deal for me as well, you know, because I could have very easily just carried on like and not really committed to that, but I wanted to just see what it felt like, I think, you know. So it is a bit of a odd sensation when you put out music under your own name.
Because did you have lots of solo productions built up by that point? And then it was like, right, this one is the one that's going to kind of kick it off.
Yes, kind of, right? So, for example, I have lots and lots of things that are sitting on hard drives and I just really, I just with that in particular, which was weirdly enough something that was made that year. It wasn't something I'd been hanging around. It was actually another track that I'd been working on, which was sounded completely different, and that key line was played over the top of another part. But then it was a case of just like muting it back just down to that key line and kind of having something that's a bit more stripped back. But you know, there's other records, like, you know, for instance, you know, the Beyond the Wizard Sleeve album, which had tracks, you know, songs on it like Black Crow and Daughter Tomorrow, were written and recorded, you know, 4 years before that. You know, I mean, even Spectrum was made around the same time as A Hold on Love was made and came out 5 years later. You know, I mean, there's no real logic to how I kind of put things out or do things in that sense, really. You know, Automatic came out during the pandemic, and that was older than even Black Crow and you know, those tracks from that made in 2009. That was made in 2008, I think, or something like that, or maybe 2009 as well. You know, so just things just are made and exist, and in my head they're there, and then it's a case of like what you want to put out there and share with people.
I'm interested in the title as well, Hold on Love, because in electronic music, from what I found, you get some people that just make loads of tunes and like, right, you know, I'm going to call it this, that's got nothing to do with it, but it's just like a sort of good title. And I don't know, it doesn't strike me that was just a title that was hanging around, right? That
no.
Actually have a connection, no?
Yeah, in the middle bit, basically, and maybe only I can hear this, but in the middle bit, you know, there's a melody that goes in the breakdown. Go, na, na, na. So basically, I've been given, I was at a party a few weeks before I made that track. And there was a guy called Will there who was like, he worked in music, but started to do a film. We just got talking. And he said something about like he had this like old sampler, an Akai S612, which are super limited. They can sample for like 6 seconds or something. And he said, yeah, I've got this like old sampler. I'm using it as a doorstop at the moment. Don't want it. And I said, oh, if you don't want it, like, because I'll take it off your hands. You know, I love 80s, you know, rack gear or whatever. And he was just like, yeah, all right, I'll just bring it around to you. So literally a few days later, he turned up around my house with this Akai S612 with its disk drive and gave it to me. And I used it all over that EP. It actually helped me finish it because I found that by having a limitation or having something that I could play with that wasn't looking into a screen and wasn't, didn't have any of the kind of, let me say it this way. It was a completely different creative realm, basically, because, you know, you put a sound into a sampler, spread across the keyboard, and you just mess around and you play with the filters and the module, whatever, and you can make kind of things that you can find interesting. And I was just merely just like putting my voice into it and then making like pads and chords and stuff like that. And that middle section was me, I don't know what I said into the microphone, but I sang something into a microphone, put across the keyboard and played that melody in. And to me, it sounded like the words, A, Hold on, Love. If you listen to it, you know those things you get on Instagram where it says, like, it says someone's saying a sentence and they're saying, what can you hear? Mm. And then and you go, it's a bit like, I forgot what the scientific term for this is, the name for it. But, you know, if you're looking at some words and you hear a sound, you hear the words. You know, you've seen that. There's so many of those things that keep coming on my Instagram where it's like, are they saying this? Are they singing that? Is that what they're chanting? And you can hear every single one of the things in that thing. And I always hear A, Hold on, Love whenever I hear that part. But I suppose other people won't, because they won't assume that's where it comes from. But that's where it came from.
So I don't know. No one really likes having their music compared to other things. But I mean this in a very good way. that it always reminds me of Big Fun by Inner City.
Yeah, you're not the only person to say that, if it's any consolation. However, whenever I listen back to Big Fun, and it is, it's kind of different because the I think my part is, I think they're triads, and it's consistent. But Big Fun, the amazing thing about the Big Fun riff is that there's a lot of I don't know what the musical term for it is, but it has more of a musicality in that sense. It's more of a kind of my fit was literally just ham-fisted riff over the top on a Juno, you know. But I have listened to them back to back, and they are quite, if you listen to them back to back, they're very different. But there is a bit of the, you know, because of the phrasing, it's understandable that, you know, but then again, I hear lots of records from that era that aren't a million miles away from, like, probably closer to A Hold on Love than Big Fun. Yeah. That's not trying to dig myself out of a hole or anything, but, like, you know, it's not, you know, the Hold on Love riff is not anything like brand new, you know, I'll be the first to say that. It's just playful and it's euphoric, but it's also very sad at the same time. And that's all I needed. You know, that's all that was enough to make me go, oh, I like this. Do you know what I mean? You know, when you ask, like, what made you want to release it, it's pretty much that. It touched upon, you know, that kind of, that sense of melancholy that I have always felt from a lot of music I love. Yet there was you know, there's the gentle proposition of euphoria in there as well, you know, which I really liked as well. So, you know, that's tied to that part, you know. But if you were to listen to them, you know, I wouldn't want to sit there with a, you know, with a pie chart and a overhead projector and a pair of speakers and try to dissect it to you know, to have anyone agree with me. But, you know, when I listened to it for my own peace of mind, then I was like, no, it's musically, yeah, it's a different thing, you know, in that sense.
Oh, no, I think what I was getting at was that sort of melancholic euphoria, which is one of my favourite things in dance music, you know. I mean, where you've got that song that's kind of, on the face of it, it's euphoric, but there's like something tugging away at it, which is like, you know, I don't like Promised Land, you know, it's like a great example, you know, it's like going to the Promised Land. It doesn't sound like it's kind of be right, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I mean, you know, there's a lot to be said about, just how much we really like fall into like the minor key, you know, by default, you know, musically. You know, have you seen those videos online on YouTube where they take songs that are like in the minor key and shift them to the major key?
Yeah.
And they're just painful, you know? you know, I feel that maybe the fact that what I love from music and community and dance floor and clubs is that sense of the feeling of very much being aware that you're on your own, but you're not on your own. You know, you're kind of in, you're amongst other people and you're all responding to the same impulse, or, you know, and you're all connected to some degree. And I think a really important part of that is like self-awareness, you know? And I think that's where the melancholy kind of part comes in, and it offers some kind of, it's some kind of bond between people, you know. Having said that, you know, like, you know, the brashness of things like bar chords and major key and just, you know, full throttle energy and how people respond to that is also incredible, you know. And I know that from going to loads of, like, you know, guitar indie gigs where it's just been, you know, full on and there's not a D minor or an E major seventh amongst any of that. Do you know what I mean? It's all D, G, C, A, full on, like, you know. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, but in dance music, I suppose. Yeah, I think what I just said is all I could offer there, really. Not much else.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I was just remembering I think it was the major key version of Smells Like Teen Spirit, which is really god awful.
Yeah, actually, so it's Losing My Religion.
Oof.
It actually makes you, like, it makes parts of your body just, I don't know, it really feels odd, doesn't it? It's really unsettling.
Yeah. How such a small shift can make something so wrong.
Well, I think it's also down to, you know, depending on where you're from around the world, you know, obviously the scale of what you respond to is going to be, you know, key, literally, you know. So, you know, I suppose, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I suppose a lot of what we have experienced or grown up with in the UK, it, you know, has its roots in, you know, folk music fundamentally, you know? So yeah, maybe that might have something to do with it.
So I was gonna say, Hold On Love kind of had a very much a life beyond just the dance floor, right? Like, what's the strangest place you've heard it?
It was on a Chanel catwalk, which was quite kind of interesting. But it worked. Other strange places I've heard it. I mean, that was quite unexpected, I think. I mean, it came out so long ago, you know, that it had that flurry of being played, like, in a variety of places by a lot of people and stuff. And I think what was quite strange, I remember, like, this was absolutely beautiful and a little strange at the same time, but it was actually before it came out, and I gave it, like, I think it was like an unmastered version of it to Daniel Avery, and he did a stream. I think it was for, what was it support of? Would it have been Drone Logic? Maybe Drone Logic had just come out, and he'd done a stream from Fabric, but he was playing in the club, and the club was completely empty. So it was like, you know, it was obviously like the inverse of something like Boiler Room, you know, where it's full of people, and so it's very still and calm. And that was quite strange, hearing it, you know, in that environment, but with no people.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd say that in Chanel.
I mentioned that it was your debut solo release. I find it, the way you got into production, quite interesting, because am I right, you started in bootlegs even before DJing, or was it like, sorry, not bootlegs, mashups? Like,
well, yeah, sorry, continue, please.
No, that's it. I was just trying to work out what was first, really.
I started recording, making music when I was a kid, basically, like going right back to like 10 years old. And then when I got older, like, got a sampler on the back of an Amiga computer in the mid to late 90s, and was sampling things and trying to make my own tunes then. And then from being in a band, I was always the guy who would record the band on a 4-track, then an 8-track. And then I then was asked to kind of help friends' bands record them. And then, that was in the 90s. So it was still a few years till I then got into mashups and stuff, or bootlegs, because, you know, after like the Amiga computer, I got into 4-track recorders. And it wasn't until 99, I think, that I got back into computers. And to be honest with you, also making mashups live, like on one deck of a CD player, and recording it onto mini disc, and then editing it on mini disc. if you know this, but like you could record onto a mini disc and then you can like really tune into like the start of a beat maybe or a kick, cut it, turn it into its own track, and then move that track further down the track list.
I didn't know that. No,
but I used to edit tracks like that
on the cut. Jesus.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard, but it was also, you know, you had time when you got time when you're young. You know what I mean? You just will sit there and you'll spend an evening like making a re-edit of something by doing that, and then you, you know, bounce it out almost, like record it all together. And I do like the first one that got a lot of attention. Where was the second one? I can't remember. Like there's the like the one with the George Michael one was done just like by mucking around on one belt drive deck, and that was both on vinyl. But the Sugar Babes Dr. Dre one was literally a CD single with the instrumental the Sugar Babes on, and the Dre a cappella on a belt drive deck, and I just recorded onto a mini disc, and that was it. And then I got a PC around 99-ish. Got a PC, and someone gave me like a copy of Acid, like a software program, and also Cubase, and I started like learning how to use that all again, you know?
Yeah.
Because I kind of knew programming from when I was a kid. So I've always been like quite curious by programming, and so when, you know, I kind of felt that, like, you know, when you just like making a record really is just putting, you know, an idea or a feeling or something down to kind of share it with someone else, you know. So, you know, even though those things were really simple, you know, there's a lot of space to do them badly, you know. There's a lot of bad ideas that they could be, but you know, I kind of went from when that was kind of like when I was kind of losing excitement from doing those things, you know, I got into remixing really, you know, and that was really good fun. But again, you know, there's only so much that I knew or know at any one time, you know, so the rest of it, you're just trying your luck.
And did remixing just come about because, you know, Trash was doing so well, people were like, well, do you reckon you want to remix this then, this tune you're playing, or?
A little bit, like the first remix that I was asked to do was for a band called Ikara Cult.
I remember them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a track called Maybe One Day, and it was the track, my remix was called Maybe One Day Too, and it was, I did it under the name Giesback. Which was the name of the street I grew up on in Archway. I mean, they asked me, they just said, oh, you know, they could, yeah, you know, by that point I was like DJing outside of Trash a lot. And there were people who were very like curious about electronic music. And they just said, oh, you know, would you fancy doing a remix? So I was like, yeah, sure. You know, I didn't really know what I was going to do until I got to the studio on that one. And a friend of mine called Yeston, like, you know, helped me out a bit so we could, like, make it in a day, you know, just with, you know, using, I can't remember what, I think we used Logic on that one. But yeah, it was, I was just like, just putting ideas down and, like, sent it to them, and they really loved it, and it came out.
I mean, you remixed some really big bands. I mean, like, you did Daft Punk, for example. Were you ever sort of intimidated?
I've never really got, like, people say to me, like, you know, do you get nervous before DJing? I've never been nervous before DJing, really. Literally because I just know that, like, it's all on me, you know what I mean, to kind of deliver. I try to take control of that in that sense. I don't let it be something to intimidate me. I try to view it as something that's like a positive, you know, like, you know, I'm lucky, or it's great that I'm in that position to do something, you know, and that's it. And view it from that angle, because I don't want to feel like, even though I feel that it's really natural to feel that, you know, like people talk of things like imposter syndrome and stuff like that. People don't, you know, shouldn't be having the opportunities they're having, which I could completely understand. I also feel that, like, no, if you're there doing it, then there's a reason, you know, there's a reason why you've got to that point. It's not a fluke, you know, because you could be amazing at what you do and no one notices and no one gives you that break. And what are you then? Are you actually good enough or not good enough? You know? So it's a really, like, I just view things of, like, if you're in a situation, if you're in a position, like, just throw yourself into it. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. I've kind of seen things from both sides. Like, you know, that, like, in the noughties, you know, people would say, you know, things like, or people be very, very staunchly, like, anti-major label, very pro-independent label or whatever. And at the time, in reality, I was coming across people who worked at independent labels who were wonderful. And I was coming across people who worked at major labels who were wonderful. And I was coming across people from indie labels, you know, who were arseholes, and some in majors that were arseholes as well. And the reality is that, like, you know, it's not just, like, it's not that binary, you know, like, you know, you work here, then you are this.
Yeah.
You work here, then you are this. You know, it's not like that. The world isn't like that. And I think this, and I felt that, you know, I didn't want to, like, you know, I've had opportunities to work with some of the biggest people on the planet in music, and they're really nice people, and they're really kind, and you can see how they got to where they got to. And they treat people really well, right? And, you know, I've come across people at the other end of the spectrum who are super cool and maybe having a thing, and it's not been the same kind of experience, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, vice versa, you know? I think if people are, you know, people like Daft Punk, the Chemical Brothers, you know, I kind of know on a personal level. So there is that kind of, like, relationship in that sense where, a little bit like, the artists that you see and their stature is slightly diffused for me, because there's more of a personable kind of side to it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I had something when, like, I did something for Todd Rundgren, which I was a little bit like, wow, like, I never expected that to happen. And he was super cool, you know? You know, it literally invited me to, like, join them on stage in, like, I can't remember what it was it in Denmark maybe, or Sweden, or Norway, I think, at a festival. And I never thought in a million years something that could happen, you know? But, like I say, you know, in all of this, like, if it happens, like, you know, let it happen.
Yeah.
You know, enjoy it, because, you know, that's the beauty of life.
You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.